Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome to our, hi. It's nice to be able to see actual faces. It's a treat. welcome to our first disability accommodation meeting, or as we've affectionately come to call them, the DAM meetings for fall 2020. And we thought that fall would be a good theme for this meeting because as you might think of fall, you think of leaves, and we know that you all are all big fans of leaves. So, and with the leaves of fall and their changing colors, as always, the leaves in our worlds here are also ever changing. So today we're gonna be focusing on some fairly substantive changes that either are coming or are upon us. And we'll be focusing on in particular, Senate Bill 1159, which has implications specific to data reporting as well as workers' compensation presumption. We'll be looking at Assembly Bill 1867 and then throwing in a couple other little potpourri items to spice it all up, or pumpkin spice it all up, however you guys want to do it. and then, as always, our format here is very informal. If you have questions, please use the chat feature or put your hand up and let us know, and Tracy can unmute you and we can have Q&A that way as well. So before we get started, just a quick introduction again. Our disability accommodation meetings are hosted by our CEO benefits team of Tracy Sewell and Ken Mizuno, along with our CEO risk divisions, our disability management division, and our workers' compensation division. Our disability management division is composed of Jess Alanez and Courtney Bishop. And Courtney is currently out of the office for a little bit, so Jess is really the one who's holding down the fort while she's gone. So if you have questions in the course of the next several weeks, please be sure to let Jess know, and he'll be happy to help you out. And then from our workers' compensation division, we have Dorothy Davis and Julie Miller here with us as well. So we're gonna try to jump into things here a little bit right away so we can get you a bunch of information. And I see that we've kind of increased our numbers here. Hopefully we've got some folks here with us today who are going to be not only affiliated with the leave piece of things, but also some of our safety control members who are looking at lost safety issues. This will also, I think, probably be a cooperative effort between both sides of the house within given agencies as to how you choose to manage some of these things. So before we jump into Senate Bill 1159, I'm going to turn it over to Tracy, and she's going to talk just a little bit about Assembly Bill 1867.
Thank you, Catherine. All right, good morning, everybody. I just quickly wanted to mention this Assembly Bill 1867 that the governor signed early in September. This is the California COVID-19 Supplemental Paid Sick Leave Act. And basically what it is for any employees who are excluded from the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, that would be like emergency responders or healthcare providers. Anybody who was not able to collect the emergency paid sick leave, they would be able to collect it now under this new California law. So the only thing that we're waiting on is county council is reviewing. They don't believe that it applies to us, but we are waiting for that determination from them. And once we get that, we will be sending out an all employee email. So just so you know that we know about it and we're looking into it, and we'll let you know what either way, whether it applies to us or not.
Great, Kathy, thanks.
Did you want me to talk about the EDD stuff as well right now?
Sure. So you want to throw that into your potpourri mixture here for them?
Sure. So as most of you on this call who have been with us through this entire 6 months since the whole COVID thing started, you'll recall that in the beginning, people were applying for unemployment because unemployment was in California was opened up to people who didn't have work available due to the COVID, the pandemic. So we did have several employees apply. So we just about a month ago, we received our quarterly EDD report for April through June. So this was the majority of the people that filed after the pandemic hit. And I just want you to know, we just finished a preliminary audit. We did find 51 employees who collected full county pay through that entire quarter, but they also collected unemployment. So we will be reaching out to departments. We're going to reach out to HR managers and lead case managers just so we can get some follow-up on this. Perhaps the employee, I don't know, didn't realize they were collecting double pay or whatever. So we'll have to get it straightened out because EDD, I'm sure you've seen in the news, they're almost a year behind in their audits. So this would not be caught until next year, and then our employees would be having to repay. So they're going to have to repay either way, but we'll look at the results once the agency reps look at it and try to get some repay agreements set up with employees. But anyway, I'll be reaching out, or one of us will be reaching out to each of the agency reps once we have those, all the results pretty final.
Any questions specific to the EDD audit anyone wants to throw in there before we move on? I just realized too, we didn't have our fun name something for 2020 theme. We blew that part that we've been giving you. So we have one question, Tracy. Do you want to address that one before we move on?
Yeah, so that is a good question, Francisco. Will they repay the county or the EDD? So typically EDD would go back and try to collect the funds, but because the audit is so far behind on their end, we are doing repay agreements for the employees to repay the county. Well, and it's the county, I'm sure most of you already know this, but the county is self-insured for unemployment. So either way, it's coming out of the county's pocket. So we'll be collecting it back on the payroll side for any time. Well, and there were some employees that had full reg for those months. So I'm not sure how we'll do all the adjustments, but that'll all be figured out, I'm sure, in the near future.
Any other questions? Obviously, if they pop in your head later, you can put them up, but any other questions on either of the topics that Tracy's covered? Okay. So moving on, before we get fully immersed into SB 1159, we also wanted to take a time, just a couple minutes, to talk about something that we think is timely, just as a simple reminder. As election season is basically upon us, we wanted to make sure everybody was reminded as to what the leave entitlements and requirements are as far as those who might want to take some time to go and exercise their right to vote. So I'm going to turn it over to Jess, and he's going to talk about the leave to vote policies.
Yes, good morning, everyone. So as Catherine mentioned, it is election season, so we'll be having the election in November. So times have changed a bit, and most of everyone knows that it's due to COVID. So this year, we'll see a large-scale effort to facilitate vote by mail. So a lot of people will be getting their ballots by mail, but voting in person will still serve as an option in Ventura County. We've kind of linked the list in-person voting locations and list of ballot drop-off locations as well. So once we conclude the presentation, we'll make this available too. Next slide, please.
Sorry, Tracy, you're muted. Is it not advancing?
I have so many screens open, so it's hard to tell which one is which, but I thought I advanced it. Let me see.
And while she's doing that, it's kind of an asterisk to let everyone know that locations and times may change depending on the climate of that day in particular. So if you want the most up-to-date, just continually look up that link so you can get the most up-to-date information about the drop-off sections and the in-person voting locations as well. So more specifically, the election code section 14000A is the law of what it says onto the right, but the summary is under California law, employees have the right to take enough time off from work to vote if they are unable to do so during off-work hours when polls are open. So that's just the summary of it, but the kind of administration is going to be on the next section. Okay, section, same section code B and should be C, so that was my fault. No more than 2 hours of time for voting shall be without loss of pay. Okay, so kind of highlighting the four bullet points for section B and C is any additional time needed by the employee can be unpaid unless MOA provisions or personal rules and provides otherwise. So we want to make sure that we just reference those before we actually give the approval. Time off for voting shall be only at the beginning or end of the regular work shift, unless the employee and employer agree to other arrangements. So keep that communication open. And during this time, it's important to be flexible and reasonable. If the employee believes that the time off will be needed to vote on election day, he or she must give at least 2 days notice before the election. So that's important. If they feel that they're going to be for example, someone in fire that has 24-hour shifts and they are going to take both those shifts, then they would just need to give us proper notification and they will be given the time off accordingly. And just some resources and information. So again, to highlight, November 3rd is going to be the presidential general election. So that's the big day. Vote by mail ballots are available and will be sent out starting October 5th, right around the corner through the 27th. And I've also added some links if anyone has any general questions. The recorder link, the first one, is the one that actually has the mail by drop-off sections and by person, so that could be updated in this climate, maybe even daily. So it is important to continuously look through that section to confirm if the information is up to date. Right, thank you guys.
We do have one question on it's not a question, it is a comment back when we were talking about the unemployment, the EDD report, and it is a good point. So somebody was saying that at their last agency, they found that there was a lot of fraud issues. People were filing, using someone else's name. So that is true. That is another reason why we will be sending these out to the agencies so they can work with the employees to ensure that somebody didn't file benefits on their behalf. Because what will happen is EDD will eventually contact us and ask us what the employee was paid. We'll tell them that they were fully paid, and then EDD is going to go after them to return the money. If it wasn't them and it was somebody else fraudulently applying on their behalf, we certainly would like to know that now rather than later. So good point. Thank you for bringing that up. Okay, and then another question. With everyone getting mail-in ballots, does the 2 hours to vote differ this year?
Yeah, so depending on the employee's circumstance, it just has to be reasonable. For example, if they do have the mail-in ballot, then they can personally drop it off at some of those locations. The locations that are jotted down now, some of them are open 24 hours. So in that case, it may not be applicable. But if an employee, let's say, commutes and has their locations in a different city, then it could be reasonable to have that conversation of what is the time allotted. They would actually have to give some type of reasonable account to why they need such time off if it is beyond 2 hours. So I guess the important message here is communicate with the employees, let them know of their resources to vote, and let them know the information that the mail-in ballots are being sent. And if they have any questions on that, just have them early so we could kind of discuss that. So again, they would have to give us some type of reasonable explanation of why they would need so much time.
Thank you, Jess. And then one last question. Do you know offhand which unions would be the exception?
I do not. I try to look through a specific time. For the most part, they all kind of lean on what is already lost or the 2 hours pay. And if more, it could go unpaid. But again, that would be a discussion for the department and the employee if they do need more than that.
I think there's one more question. Tracy, somebody asked, what is considered enough time? And go ahead, Jess.
Yeah, and again, it's what's reasonable. So for example, if someone is the commuting situation and their poll is open, we'd have to double check, but the poll maybe say open from 8 to 6 and they get off at 5 o'clock. So it could be reasonable to let them go so they can go vote for that time because of the commute. Let's say that same scenario that they're asking to leave to vote at 1 o'clock. Well, they would have to give some type of reasonable explanation that the time it takes for them to vote would be between the hours of 1 and 6 when the polls are open. So it is, again, up to that communication to let everyone know of why they need the time. If it does sound kind of like they could do better, then review those options. Make sure that they are reviewing the controller's information online and let them know that they do have other options. For example, if they do have a mail-in ballot and they are on the work site, then I believe the county has a drop-off station. So on their way to work, they could actually drop it off. But it is important to have those conversations so we give them the right to vote, but we're not taking anything away, but they are fully aware of all options.
Okay, great, thank you, Joss. So why don't we, Tracy, could you load in for me now? We'll move on to Senate Bill 1159, which is the main attraction for today's leave get together. So as a starter, hopefully most of you have already gotten some preliminary information as it relates to this Senate Bill 1159. Chuck Pode, who's here today with us, he put together a memo that was distributed to all of the agencies that gave an overview. And today we're going to try to just give you a bit more of a drill down. I'm guessing there's probably going to be some questions as we go through this as to sort of what does a certain process or definition mean in things. And we're going to do our best to answer that for you. And I will say that admittedly, there's some things that the legislature has kind of left a little bit fuzzy. And I think in time, those things will be further defined and further made clear to us as different groups sort of challenge the intent of the law. But nonetheless, this is our kind of starting shot to get us all on the right page and get things going. So on September 17th, the Governor Newsom did sign into law Senate Bill 1159. And basically, it's what's called urgency legislation, meaning it took effect upon the date that it was signed. And with it, it brings to us new COVID reporting requirements, as well as new rules for when an employee's COVID positive diagnosis might be something that entitles them to workers' compensation benefits. So the presumption, it gives us sort of these new requirements that are unique, I think, in that the data we're gathering is data that's going to be used to make a determination as to whether an employee might get a COVID presumption for their workers' compensation claim. However, in order to determine that, the reporting requirements require that we capture information regarding any employee that we learn of who tests positive for COVID-19, even if the employee does not believe that their exposure to the virus is related to work. So we're gathering information regardless of whether the employee, says, hey, I just went on a trip to, South Dakota, and on my way back, I got COVID. We still have to report those incidences. What the statute doesn't require us to do is to basically have to track down information where we wouldn't reasonably already be aware of it. So meaning that if you have an employee who tells you that they're positive, if somebody else, the manager says they have information that they're positive, okay, now we have knowledge. And those are the ones that we're going to want to be following up on. You may also from time to time receive notification from public health that you have an employee who's positive. And again, obviously that is now knowledge to us as the employer, and we need to take action when we have that knowledge. Go ahead and change it, Tracy. Okay, so what does this new law do? First, it creates what's called a rebuttable workers' compensation presumption. So what is a rebuttable presumption in workers' compensation? A rebuttable presumption means that we have to assume in cases where they meet the criteria that the exposure came from work. We have the ability to put forward evidence to try to offer an alternate source, but we have to work from the presumption that where the employee got the virus was at work. Within that rebuttable presumption, there's actually two different categories of employees. So the presumption itself is being applied differently depending upon where you work. So the first part is that the rebuttable presumption applies to employees who do direct patient care at a healthcare facility, they do healthcare custodial work, or they're active safety members, for instance, law enforcement, fire, and in-home supportive service providers. If you have employees who fall into any of these categories, automatically we are to assume that if they get COVID, that they got it from work. So that means in those cases, if you have people that fall within those categories, you're gonna need to give them, when they tell you that they're positive COVID, they need to get an employee claim form when you learn of that positive exposure. On the other hand, now we have a second group of employees, which is essentially everyone else who's not listed in category one. In that case, employees might be entitled to a presumption as well. However, in order for the presumption to apply, we would have to show that we have had what is defined as an outbreak within 14 days of the date that the employee took the test for the positive result. And I do think that's an important distinction to make, is that the 14 days is from the date the test was taken, not the date that the test results were received. So that's the timeline that we're looking at. So what is an outbreak? So first of all, in order to define an outbreak, a work site has to have five or more employees who work at it. I would think that pretty much in every county facility, we're going to meet that first threshold probably in almost every instance. So as long as you've had five or more employees at this employee's particular work site, then we have to look at what is they're calling the four or four rule. So if less than 100 people work at a location and four employees test positive in a 14-day period, then that site is considered to have an outbreak for the application of the workers' compensation presumption. And again, I think it's an important distinction. This definition of outbreak is simply for looking at whether the workers' compensation presumption would be applied. So it doesn't have a broader definition to other implications. It is simply a methodology used within workers' compensation to determine whether the presumption would apply. The second scenario that we're looking at in the four or four rule is if you have more than 100 employees who are working at a specific place of employment, then if 4% of those employees within a 14-day period have a positivity, and again, positivity from any source, any location, but they were within that location within the 14 days, then again, we would have what would be described in workers' compensation for the presumption as an outbreak. So you know, just to make that point one more time, is that even if you have safety workers or healthcare workers who fell into the first tier where we presume it, whether they don't have to show this four rule. If you have employees who fall into that category, we still need to be accounting for positivities within those locations, because within each of your locations, you might have safety workers, but you also have non-safety workers. Same in healthcare. You have people who are providing direct patient care and then employees who are not. So you're still going to need to account for all of this data, even if the population you're working with includes safety or healthcare workers. And I think there may be a question, Tracy, so can we go to that just to make sure I'm answering people's questions in real time here?
Sure. So it says, would you send out the PowerPoint for the COVID-19 positive test?
So everything that we are discussing today, we will be putting on our intranet site. So this, everything related to COVID, this particular PowerPoint will be on the COVID intranet site. And if anyone doesn't have the link to that, we can certainly provide it to you. Anything such as the stuff that Jess provided on the voting and the more generalized information will go on the disability accommodation meeting intranet site as well.
Okay, thank you. And for number of workers, would you consider cleaning vendors? I think like janitors.
So, and I'm gonna, Chuck, you feel free to, if Tracy has the power to unmute you if you, if needed. But so I just attended a webinar on this. And again, as I said, I think there's a lot of things that are open to interpretation, but it does appear that most legal authorities who are reviewing these things are saying, no, this is about your actual employees. So not a visitor, not a vendor. This is, we have a requirement to report specific to people we employ. So I would not consider vendors to be part of that equation.
Okay, and if they have a site with two employees, and one courier visits regularly from GSA, I'm assuming, but GSA and or cleaning crew visit on a semi-regular basis, would this count for a 5-person employee site?
So this is where these are good questions for which there are complicated, non-satisfying, probably answers. But I think what we're looking to do is to say, how many of your employees were within a given site? So you're accounting for your employees, not other people. Now in that, in the example that you gave, if the courier now is also going to say, hey, I visited all these different locations. You know, I was in this location, and this location. Ultimately, we're going to have to request data from each of those locations where the GSA employee went to see if that location had an outbreak within their own employee population. But that GSA courier is not your employee reporting to your work site. So hopefully that makes sense, is that I think what you're being asked to account for is the people you are asking to direct to your work site.
Hey, Catherine?
Yeah.
Oh, it worked. I'm not sure if that's correct. So we will have to take a look, because I think what it looks at is county employees. And so if you work for the DA's office and a GSA worker comes into your work site, then that is still a county employee. But if you work for the DA's office and court employees now come into your work site, they work for the courts, those are folks that we do not have to count.
And and as best as you can, and to Chuck's point, I mean, again, some of these are it's very nuanced. And I think there's, it's complicated, you know, when these laws are written, people have a vision of what it is. I think the vision isn't that you have such fluid work environments for some employers as we do. So I think at the end of it, what we're hoping is that people are going to account for it as best as they can. We will certainly, we'll work to get some clarity on this particular question. And honestly, your questions help us to sort of drill down a little bit too on things that we need to ask some more questions on. So based on Chuck's response, I think then the answer there is that as best as you can account for any county employee who's within your facility on a given day, at least for now, that's what you want to do. And we will provide further clarification as we move forward.
And one last question. Does the count include Century 22 temp workers who work alongside county employees?
And again, and Chuck, I leave it to you to tell me if you disagree, but I believe, again, we are being asked to account for our employees. So these right. folks are employed by a temp agency. We do not employ them. So the answer, as far as my interpretation goes, is no.
That's correct.
Okay. Great. Good questions. Thank you. So what's our responsibility then as it relates to this new law with regards to gathering data and providing that data? So we need to do two different things. The first part is we need to look backwards in a period of time that the law requires us to account for all of this data from the period of July 6th through September 17th. And we are going to have to be able to account if you had a positive employee from July 6th to September 17th, for each of those individuals, we're going to need you to be able to account for us that you had a positive and the information as to how many people were in the site during that time. And again, this is not specific to employees who are alleging that it's a work-related exposure. This is any employee, even if they told you, you know, Vegas weekend and that's where I got it, we still are going to need that information. And that data, we are required to provide that data to the county's work comp claims administrator, which is Sedgwick. We have to provide that data by October 17th, which means that for each of your agencies, we need you to go back and do this look back and provide us with an accounting of this information. If you had employees who put you on notice they were positive from July 6th to September 17th, we will need that information from you no later than October 17th.
Question, how would you like the information reported? Is a spreadsheet sufficient?
So yes, so we're going to get into a little bit more of the specifics, but yes, on the retrospective, a spreadsheet is certainly one of the options, and we'll talk a little bit more on the particulars in just a second. Okay, so as I said, there's two things we have to do. One is the look back, which we just talked about. Then the other is moving forward from September 18th. So the governor signed this law, as we said, on the 17th. It came into effect then as of business on the 18th. From September 18th going forward, all positive tests that we become aware of, we need to be able to, again, report the data associated with those positives to our work comp administrator, Sedgwick, within 3 business days. So for each of those instances now moving forward, the timeline for your departments will be 3 business days to get that information and get it over to us so that we can provide it to Sedgwick. Now, here's an important sort of distinction. What we're talking about here is just data relating to positive COVID testing and the number of employees within the location. That is separate and distinct from an individual who wants to file a workers' compensation claim. So when you are finding out at this point from the September 18th forward that an employee tested positive, if that employee believes that their condition is work-related, then you would still have to provide them with a work comp claim form. And once that form is completed and returned to you, then you would report that claim to Sedgwick through your global intake portal. So again, although this data is kind of intertwined in how it's used, those are separate requirements. If the employee thinks it came from work, you still have to do all the normal steps you would do in relationship to a work comp claim. And whether they think it's work-related or not, you have to report the data to us that they were positive and what your employee count was at their work site for the 14 days leading up to the day they were tested. So important distinction there.
One question came in. Any insight regarding the application of these laws for volunteers who are at the work site and work alongside the employees?
So again, not our employees, they're volunteers. And so by the strict interpretation of the law, and Chuck, you say differently if you feel differently, but those folks are not our employees. So not included in the count. And I mean, honestly, it's obviously as you contemplate that, does that make sense from a logical standpoint as we're calculating an outbreak? To some extent, you all, it sounds like in the questions, are applying the logic that if people were in the building, wouldn't we want to include them? But that's not the way the law is written, right? The law is just saying it's only the folks that we employ. Okay, so the third thing is, so as we said, we need to talk about the positivities when we get the positivities, and then our third responsibility is to report the highest number of employees who reported to work at that employee's specific workplace in the 45 days preceding the last day the employee worked at each specific place of employment. Okay. So essentially, just to make the comparison of where we are now in terms of on the agency level, what we're asking you guys to do and what's required. And let me just add to it that there's really substantial fines that are associated with failure to report. So either failure to report the look back data by October 17th and failure to report any new positives that come up September 18th forward within the 3 business days. Have very substantive fines attached to them. So, and I mean, the bill does kind of speak to not only failure to report timely, but also sort of an accuracy issue, meaning that there's obviously discouragement from just sort of throwing some numbers together and saying, oh, sure, this is what it was. Is it, we run the risk of having negative consequences if we're not reporting timely and we're not reporting accurately. So again, just as a comparative side-by-side, we're asking you to compile information for the employees, any employee you had who tested positive between July 6th and September 17th, and then provide that information to risk management by October 17th. And as we talked about before, you can use spreadsheets you can create your own internal spreadsheet. You can use the positive test notification form that we've created, which I'll show to you in a minute. And you can contemplate any number of manners and methods on this look back part that makes this easy for your department. We're willing to work with you with your methodology as long as it gathers all of the information that we need. And in a minute, I'll make sure you understand exactly what that is. So if there are, if there's other ways your agency happens to compile data that would allow you to more easily put this together, we want to make it as easy as we can for you. The second responsibility is September 18th forward. You need to complete a COVID-19 positive test notification form. And then you need to provide that to risk management within 3 business days. We are asking from September 18th moving forward, if you can use the form, and again, we'll look at that in a second, but that we have, because that will help us to have a more streamlined process and a consistent process as we move forward where it's more of a one-off as opposed to trying to gather all this data in a retrospective fashion. You're actually muted, Tracy.
I guess I muted myself. Okay, so a question came in. How about if an employee that has tested positive has been teleworking and has not been in the office?
So it's a great question. And the answer as it exists right now, although still under some legal analysis, but the answer as it exists right now is yes, those people are employed by us and we do have to report that data. Okay, so what needs to be on your retrospective look back spreadsheets or data analysis, however you wish to gather that? So these are just really the things that we need to know: the employee's name, their employee number, what agency, the date of knowledge, and that they had a positive test. So when did you know it? What was the day that they were actually tested? And again, that's going to be the really critical date. The date of the test results, the date they last worked before the positive test, are they working from home? And then if their specific work location, if not home, and there is a separate line for each location. So as you all have already raised in this discussion, you have employees who often work at multiple different locations within the county on a given day or a given week. We would need an accounting for each of those things. And then the highest attendance rate 45 days prior to the test results. And again, you know, we recognize that none of us knew we had to do this from July 6th to September 17th. So for some of your operations, you may really not have a clear accounting of that. The law requires that we put our best estimate forward for that. And so that's what we're asking you to do, is to try to sort of figure out how, as best as you can with the information that you have, what would be your numbers for that period of time.
All right, another question came in. Does this include all testing, for example, an antibody test?
Good question. It does not. It only is a COVID test, not antibody. So you know, again, those folks, you don't have to account for them.
If I can jump in for a second. So we recognize that trying to report the number of employees is going to be a challenge. There are some methods that we can start now to try and capture that information. I have reached out to GSA to see if we might be able to use badge swipes, people that use their badge to get into the workplace. Keeping a roster is a good idea. The purpose of the number of employees is, of course, to try and figure out, is there an outbreak? And there's a break point whether there's 100 people in the office or not. So if you're in an agency where you've got somewhere between 25 and 45 people that report to work, I think there's a lot of latitude there. We don't need the exact number because you're well under 100, which means that an outbreak is when you have 4 employees testing positive. For those locations that have over 100 employees, that's where it becomes a little more critical, because for every, 25 additional employees in the workplace, that's another notch to get to that magic 4%, whether there's an outbreak or not. So there is some latitude in here, but it will require some thought.
Okay, some questions have come in. Just to clarify, you only have to provide the retro look back if you had an employee test positive, right?
Yes. So again, if you were lucky enough to not have any employee tell you they were positive for COVID from July 6th through September 17th, you're off the hook. But we need risk management needs affirmation from you that you have assessed that and that that is the case. So we would ask that you provide us with at least some just notification, I saw Phil's question, animal services did not have anyone who tested positive during this time frame, nothing to report. That will help us to make sure we know you have gone back, you've looked at it, and we're clear on exactly what happened within your operation.
All right, and last question that I have right now. For a 24-hour facility, would we consider the attendance count for just the shift the employee works or for the entire day?
So, Chuck, that's a great question.
It is a great question. And I thought you were going to look at me and I was looking at you.
So I will say that it makes me think of Chuck and I were on Julie and Dorothy on a webinar the other day where an employee asked the question of, what about people who work in the airline industry and they fly inside an airplane? Where's their work site, and B, how many people, and that stumped the moderator on that one. So congratulations, you've done it here with this question. What's your guidance on that, Chuck?
Since it's employee based, I think it's the shift that the employee worked on. So if you've got a location that's got 110 employees during the day, but this employee worked from midnight to 8 a.m. where there's only 5 employees, I think you look at the 5 employee number, because they're looking at how many other employees could have been impacted by either this employee or the unknown source for the COVID virus.
Yep, I would agree with that. And I think that although I know that sounds in some ways like we're parsing things, hopefully with your numbers of positivities, that the numbers aren't so overwhelming, that the more you're able to limit it to that particular employee, I think the easier it's going to be for you to account for who was there and to be able to establish much more clearly whether they really were part of an outbreak exposure within the time they were working within that location. But again, these I think are all questions that, will continue to be developed and will most certainly be litigated in time. And as we learn more through the pendency of time, we'll certainly keep you guys posted, but that would be the recommendation for now.
Right. All right. And what is considered a workplace? All offices under one roof?
So again, this is another million-dollar question. Open to interpretation. I think to Chuck's point, on the shift part, we also want to look at really what a person's work site is. So I think there's argument for instance, if I come into Hall of Administration and I work only on the fourth floor and I'm not taking meetings anywhere else during the course of the time that I'm there, I think there's an argument that that my work site is Hall of Administration, fourth floor. And that's where some of this on your positivities is going to take some inquiring with the employee as to where were they and what were they doing. In other instances, there's an argument for, that it is in fact all of the offices under one roof. So I think there's some discretion there in terms of definition of worksite or workplace. I can tell you that this is for sure an issue that is going to end up being litigated over time because it's a huge question for everyone. But I think as long as you are applying, I think, thoughtful rationale and consideration for how you reached your number, and you're doing that in a consistent manner, at this point, that's the best that we can ask for. Do you disagree with that, Chuck?
No, I think that's perfectly fine. And we're here to try and walk through that analysis to try and figure it out. I know I got a call yesterday from a department, and we decided that, based upon this employee's job, that we would limit it to that department as opposed to the entire building. If it's a GSA courier, then that's going throughout the Hall of Administration, let's say, then in that case, we may elect to use the Hall of Administration as the workplace as opposed to a particular department. So I think it's going to be very fact dependent, and you know, reach out to me or Catherine and we can try and work through that analysis with you.
All right, and would the department count the number of contracted workers along with the county employees?
No, it's just county employees.
Okay, that's it for questions.
Great. So moving along in our slideshow here. So as I indicated, we're happy to try to work with you guys on the retrospective looking back. As long as we have the information that I just showed you in the previous slide, we're gonna figure out a way to get that information reported over to Sedgwick for you. But however, September 18th moving forward, we're asking that you use this particular form that's on the screen. This will then be completed and mailed to the risk management mailbox within 3 business days of your knowledge of the positive. And this particular form will help us to kind of have a very consistent manner in which we're getting the data and then able to transmit that over to Sedgwick. And so I do want to make that point because I know, again, this is a little bit confusing. So I just want to say it one more time, is that this data that you're collecting about positivities is data that you are gathering and providing to risk management. Risk management will take that data and we will transmit it directly to Sedgwick through a specific methodology Sedgwick has for us to provide the data exclusive to the idea of whether we've had an outbreak. So this is just the positivity number of employees part. You provide that to risk management. Risk management will make sure Sedgwick gets that information. Along the way, if you have an employee who is positive and they think that that positivity is related to work, or they happen to be a healthcare worker or a first responder as defined within the definition we talked about earlier, those folks are assumed to have gotten at work. Those individuals need to be given a work comp claim form, what we call the DWC-1. And if they complete that and return that back to you, then we need to then have you handle it as you would any work comp claim. And your agency would report that directly to Sedgwick through your reporting portal. So hopefully that's really clear. If people have questions as it relates to that part, please, this is a great time to make sure there's clarity on those issues. Okay. So while you digest all of that easy data that you now find yourselves responsible for gathering and considering in your day-to-day operation, we did get a couple just really brief questions. So I will turn it over to Julie and Dorothy just to run through those questions. And again, you all feel free to sort of weigh in as we go through it.
Sorry about that. I had to take myself off mute. Thank you, Catherine. So the first question is, the agencies are being asked to keep daily rosters of employees entering their buildings. How or when will the agencies be required to provide the roster records? And are there any suggestions for how to compile and maintain the roster information? Dorothy?
So the answer is, the roster of the employees entering their buildings to work is for the agency's own use, in order to be able to calculate the highest number of employees working at a specific location within 45 days of a positive COVID test result. So there's no need to provide the roster to anyone outside of the agency. And the roster should be developed to suit best suit the agency. And of course, Chuck was talking about maybe the badge swipe for a larger building, if we're gonna calculate that, would be an option. But in the meantime, a suggestion would be having a pre-printed roster with the names of all the employees who report to a particular location available at the location entrance, when the employees can place a check mark when they enter. And another suggestion would be to have a designated person keep the log on a spreadsheet of your choice.
Thank you, Dorothy. For how long are the agencies going to have to compile these daily rosters?
There is a sunset law on this, or the law sunsets on January 1st, 2023. So that's the date that you will need to continue to keep these rosters through. And if that should change, if it's, the law gets extended, then we'll let you know that when it does.
Okay, thank you. And how long will the rosters need to be maintained?
Again, based on that sunset date of January 1st, 2023, the roster should be maintained until mid-February of 2023 so that we could calculate the number of the 45 days.
Thank you. And the last question, another really good question. If the employee is going out of the country, can we or do we require a negative corona test or a certain amount of days of quarantine prior to the employee returning to work, assuming the employee cannot telework?
So I believe at this time there's no such policy for the requirement of this type. If Chuck or Catherine want to weigh in on that, you can.
And that's correct. Currently, the county does not have a policy that requires that. So, you know, like all things, if something happens and someone comes back and there's questions or concerns, they are suggesting they're symptomatic in some way, as we would anyone. We, you know, no one with symptoms should be at the workplace, and we would want to contemplate having them provide clarification as ability to return to work. And as we've shared before, if they don't have someone that they're already using as their primary, you know, medical provider, employee health can help with the screening parts of those where there's questions about whether they're appropriate to return to work. But assuming a person is not symptomatic, there's no requirements for quarantining or testing. Okay, so I know the most, well, I don't know what the most depressing part is. It's depressing that you have to gather this data. It's equally depressing you have to do it apparently until 2023. So I'm hoping that somewhere in this, there's a solution that comes to us and that will be the real reason we get to tell you it's changed, is that we just don't have to do this because maybe it's no longer an issue. But in the short term, it's where we find ourselves, and we recognize that it's yet another wrinkle in the excitement that is this whole COVID leave adventure. So as Chuck said, there's likely to be many, many questions as you find your way through this and have real world examples. So we're happy to help. Please reach out to us. You know, we will guide you and counsel you as best as we can. But some of this is going to be a learning experience, as it has been all the way through for all of us. So any final questions, as we're right up on 12 o'clock and I know people are starving and ready for lunch and don't want to hear another word about this probably. But if you have any last second things you want to throw out for the good of the group, we'll give it just a couple seconds. As I said, we will be posting everything onto the intranet sites, either on the COVID-19, SB1159 will be on COVID-19, everything else will be on our disability accommodation meeting site. And from here, we plan to keep this going on our monthly basis. So I'm sorry to tell you, there's still more changes to come that are going to be rolling out effective January 1st, but we didn't want to overwhelm you with the excitement of all of it in just one sitting. So we'll let you know what those changes are and what to expect in future meetings. And obviously, we welcome topics and thoughts you guys would like to have covered along the way as well. So thank you for your time. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for your resilience and your ability to be flexible through all this. We hear you, we get it, we're right there with you, and we'll find our way through this. But we look forward to hearing from you on or before October 17th with your retrospective accounting of positive COVID cases within your agencies. Thanks, you guys. Are you keeping her?
It's funny because I clicked remove twice, but I mean, she's fine to see.
Yeah, you're like, whatever, you can stay. Come on back. We'll take your input. Are we still? Did you stop recording?
Oh,